World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. The second Burma Railway veteran in this interview series is Keith Fowler. Like Jack Thomas, he'd enlisted in the 2nd-3rd Machine Gun Battalion, fought in the Syrian campaign, then was taken by troopship to the disastrous Java landing and captured by the Japanese. Your story is a truly remarkable one. 2nd-3rd Machine Gun Battalion, fought in the Middle East, off to Java, captured, Singapore, Burma Railway, survived all that, came back to peacetime Australia. And it wasn't easy then. Well, let's go back to the origins and your childhood and your early memories of life. Tell us a bit about that.
Actually, I'm a little bit afraid to do this because I think the coppers could still catch up with me. Could be a little bit dangerous. Oh, I don't know. I mean, we were a very close family, but we weren't a very rich family. The only thing I can mostly be, of course, Depression days. Yes. And I can always remember there was always a good table. Always. I mean, you might have the shoes, no shoes to wear. You may not have the patch in your pants and what have you, but...
You grew up, I believe, Tranmere, McGill Way?
I was born at McGill. And I went to... My first school was Wellington Road School. My uncle, who was 7 years older than I, he took me. And as soon as he dropped me off, I left there and come back home again. Used to sit in the creek until it was time to report home. But that's another story. My mum, she was a hard worker all her life. I mean, she married an ex-serviceman from the 1480 War, and
he'd been knocked around a bit in the war, hadn't he?
Well, he reckons he has. I don't know, but I mean, you hear these stories. But whatever it was, he married in Scotland during the war and had a daughter. And by the name of Evelyn, and which we didn't know anything about, and but his wife's little Scottish wife, she died with the influenza at that time, so I always thought I was the elder, but I wasn't. There was another, his brother also married a Scottish girl, and he stayed in Scotland, another Robert, and he became a doctor. So
your father was George Vollmer. Nelson Fowler.
Yeah, that's right.
George Vollmer Nelson Fowler. And I believe he had a metal plate in his head.
Well, that's the story. I mean, it's very hard to get the truth between facts and fiction, you know. But the way he carried on, I think he was mentally normally. No, actually, I think I have told you before how I come to meet the Harts, and I met my wife, and she knew the family. She was a Miss Fowler, and I mean, I never knew of them at all, but she knew my father because she was a first cousin. And she said, no, the whole family was 13 of them, and she said, your father was a nice man, she said, before the war.
And a troubled man after it.
Apparently, yes, he'd married, and then had his wife died. Then my mum was only 18 when she had me. And when I was three and my sister was just born, he cleared off.
So you were born in November 1920.
20, that's right.
And only 3 years old, your father left?
Yep.
Never saw him again?
Never saw him again, no. They did hear of him, but he was born at Red Hill. That's where the family come from. But I've often been asked, well, did you ever look for your father? And I said, no. Well, they said, well, why not? I said, well, it's very simple. I said, he left me. He didn't want me, so what the hell would I want him?
So what happened to you? You had to go and live with
relatives? Well, we went from pillar to post. the sister and I were fortunate. One of my mum's sisters was, when I say fortunate, it was a very sad thing. She had a bad birth and a tubal birth, and she couldn't have any more children. So virtually any of the family, the children that she took, you know, she looked after. Well, we lived most of our life with her, and in a sense, it had its effect on me eventually, because you were bound for. She was a very religious woman, and I had a very religious upbringing, which I wasn't prepared to conform to, sort of, until the preacher said that we were learning dancing, and I went, I'm Tom Hardy, because he said how evil the dancing was and all that. So it was a Baptist church, and I was about 15 or 16 at the time. I said, I'm not going back to church. Oh, poor old auntie. She said, no. I said, I'll go to church, but I said, I'm not having some dickhead telling me what I can do and can't do. But, you know, that's how it was.
There was a confrontation of another kind, I understand. Yeah, you were living in the Barossa Valley, and you were brought up by an aunt, but then you were living with your mother again and her second husband.
Yeah, I went up there, oh, it must have been about 10 or 11, because I went to the Angaston School for 1 year, where it was a grade 7, grade 6 and 7 I had up there. And good mum, and she, I mean, she married this chap. He was a nice bloke, Richard, Dick Bouts was his name. In fact, I still go up to Angaston to see my half-brother. And his sister.
You and your stepfather had a bit of a disagreement.
Oh, yeah, poor. I mean, things were tough, and old Dick used to like to have a bit of a bet down the shop. And once again, Bill Turner, who was my mate, he was the butcher's son there. Bill was 3 years older than I. And I used to go and work for Uncle Harry on weekends with all his dahlias and that, you know. And this Saturday, we worked from about 8 o'clock in the morning to about 5 o'clock at night, flat out. Naming them with indelible pencil, all the names, and then planting them and staking them. And I got a pair of long pants, the first pair I think I ever had, and two bob, and I was a millionaire. In the meantime, Mum, I said, I saw Bill coming home, and he said, would I like to go to the pictures? I said, yeah, I got a couple of bob. So, you know, she said, yes, that's all right. And old Dick, he'd had a few at the pub. And he had different ideas. He said I should be saving, giving the mother money to my mother. I said, well, and then it started, because I said, well, what about all the bloody money you've been spending down the pub and the races, you know? And anyway, I thought he's going to belt me, so I up with a chair, whacked him. The chair, laid him out.
Yeah. Now that was the end of that little household.
Yeah. So I said to Mum, I said, I think it's time I left. But I was very sorry, I mean, because he was a nice, that he just got, but I wasn't going to be belted by him, because after he'd, you know, what he'd been doing.
So he came down to Adelaide, and he got a job.
Yeah, oh yeah, Mitchell got me a job at Richards, so he's out at Mile End, the motor vehicle place down there. Boy, was that a job, and I would have sooner gone back up on the railway line down there.
It was harder than the Burma Railway.
Oh, gee, I was like, I'd put my age up to get there too, and I was on the spring grip. You're working on a tar dip, which you had to dip these springs into, and then you first of all you would put them in an oven and set them up all up at about 600 degrees for the spring, you know, and all that, and then you put them in a tar dip, then they go up to the spring press and they put them into squabs and all that, and my uncle used to have a bike. This is when things were bad. He used to ride all over the place to get a job. And I'm not kidding, it was heavier than a 2-ton truck. And I used to ride that from the top of Mitcham right to Mile End, and we were working night shift. You know, and I used to cry when I came, not from, but from fatigue. I was that tired. I mean, the tired, it was that stinking hot, you know, in the oven and all that. But
can you remember how much you earned for that job?
Hmm?
What your pay was for that job? Can you remember?
Ten bob a week. No, 11 bob a week, because I went down in wages when I went to the Adelaide Co-op. I went down to 10 bob, but I got on the baker's cart and I had all the buns and that in the world.
So that was a better job,
that
right?
That was a better job by a long chalk.
From there, though, war was on its way. But before the war, I understand that with a mate of yours, you went out one night down to Glenelg, and he had to put it in the parlance they used in those days. He said, "Why don't we go down to Glenelg and see if we can crack onto a couple of sorts?" That was impressionable.
That was George Tilley, who played for Sturt.
Yeah.
Well, this is we've been to Endeavour in the morning.
Right.
You had two services. You had Christian Endeavour, then you had a quarter-hour service, the main service, and before we left, I said to Artie, I said, and this was another strange thing. I would have never met my wife if Tilley had to said to go down, and we'd never ever thought of it beforehand. So that's what we did. We went down the bay, and that's what happened.
And he met these two lovely girls.
Yeah, well, and one turned out to be my second cousin.
Yes.
You know, so once again, fate had a strange way of working. And as usual, Hayes had something wrong with her. She had a toothache.
So this was Hazel,
the
young lady who would eventually become your wife.
Yeah, yes. And Eddie went with Nancy for... She'd just broken up with her boyfriend. They'd been going together for eight, and eventually they broke up. But no, we used to go down the bay, down there quite a lot, you know, after that.
Then come July 1940, you enlisted, 2nd, 3rd Machine Gun Battalion.
I was medically unfit. I went there, I went down, it was about 5th of July, I think, if I'm not mistaken, around about that time, and there was about 40 of us, and we'd all been at a medical and all the rest, we were all ready to walk over, get our palliasses and all the rest, and we called him Deep Purple, he was a Syrian, and he said, "Mr. Fowler, you stand fast." And I didn't know what bloody stand fast.
This was the doctor?
This was the sergeant.
The sergeant?
Sergeant. Yeah. So they all walked off. He said, "Mr. Fowler," he said, "I have to present you with this." And I got it, I can't remember it. I think it was a green form. I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Well, you read it." On there it says, this person is medically unfit to serve home or abroad. And I said, I looked at him in absolute, utter astoundment. I said, "You've got to be kidding." He said, "Well, that's what it is. You better go and see your doctor." I said, "I'm not seeing no doctor." So I tore it up in front of him. And his words were, "Mr. Fowler, you might be sorry you ever did that."
Yeah. So you had your leave ticket, in a sense.
Yeah.
But you literally tore it up.
Yeah. And I don't know, need have gone in the army at all. I just had my certificate. So some other poor bloke got in there. He either got out very soon, became one of the first TMPIs, I should imagine.
Right. Okay.
You know. But anyway, I went home and I thought about it. I told my auntie what had happened, she saw. So I went down the Air Force. Because if they don't want me, I'll try the Air Force. But being very naive, I didn't realise that air gunners only lasted about 30 seconds. Mm. But I put in to be an air gunner. I told them about experience with machine guns and what have you and all that. So they said, "Well," and you had to be pretty well educated, but you didn't have to be for a gunner, you know. And so anyway, I waited about a week, 10 days, so I said, "Oh, beg of this." So I'll go back to Wavell again. For 3 days I was in the army. 2 days after getting the army, I got a call from the Air Force. So I had to notify that I'd already enlisted in the army.
So you could actually have had another escape route there.
Yeah. If that had transpired, I'd gone into the Air Force. Mm-hmm. I'd most likely been swept out of that plane years ago.
Anyway, the army had you the second time around.
Went through like a piece of cake. Yeah, there was no trouble at all.
And from there, you met your commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel
Blackburn,
yeah.
VC. Yeah, he was a very nice man, Blackie.
But believed in fitness, physical fitness.
Oh, God, yes, he was a physical maniac, marches all over Gadlate, everywhere, down the side, yeah. But we were fit, I think we were the only unit in Australia that did that, that march. Mm. And we were very, very fit.
And so from there to the Syrian campaign.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You saw active service for the first time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just a normal active service. It'll get in your car, away you go, set up your machine gun and what have you, and then you get shifted somewhere else, you know. That was about it. Fired a few shots.
Yes, but you came under fire yourself.
Oh yeah, yeah, we go, yeah, we got, they're 75 millimetres, they got stuck into us, and we finished up in an old house, a big tall room house, and it was, had all galvanised iron, I don't know why, inside, and we were in there when the plane came over and strafed it.
So you've been in action in Syria, you've been under fire, and then we have peace for a while because the Vichy French are defeated. What happens to you next?
Well, what happened to us next? Oh, well, we just stayed in Lebanon. We went to different camps and all that. I think it was Beshmazine was when we left from Beshmazine to come home. There was a little village there. This is after it all over and all the rest of it. And I met a family there. Actually, George was the son of this family, the eldest son and the daughter, I think. The son was a lecturer at the university in Haifa or some such thing. Anyway, George came up this day to the camp and he said, "You come back to my place." He tried to get one of the blokes to come down. So I had none. I said, "Yeah, I'll come home, George." They were a lovely family. There was the bishop and her eldest sister and the son and young George. And I used to just go down there for night time, and before we left, they said, "You leave," he said, "very soon." I said, "Oh, you leave very soon." So I went and pinched two grey blankets out the store they had there and gave them to Nabeer and her sister. And within 2 days when I went down there, they'd made these washing coats out of them. They were beautifully made, you know. And so they said, "Well..." Then we got word we were leaving within a week, so they knew. So they just said, "Well, you come, we give you a dinner before you go." I said, "Okay, well, yes, I'll be there." So that was my first taste of Arak. They laughed, they reckon my eyes turned red and what have you. And anyway, after it was all over, I had this, it was rabbit, cooked rabbit, red kidney beans and all the rest of it. And poor old George, after he said, "Mr. Fowler," he said, "do you enjoy your meal?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, my dad killed our pet rabbit for you." I said, "I wished I could bring it back, George." Yeah, but that's how they were, you know. And they made 2 Damascus silk cushions. I said, "What were they like?" But they said, I gave them my address, but they never ever got back to Australia. I think they got waylaid somewhere along the line.
Yeah, well, you got waylaid too, because you were set off on a big ship, and you were headed to...
Oh, yeah, well, from Java. There, yeah, well, we finished up down at Port Chufing.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where we're going to... and at that stage, we didn't know we were going to another battlefield or whatever, or what was going on, and no idea that we were coming back to Australia, because when they asked for volunteers, we'd have all fallen out, you know. So, and that's what transpired there at Port Chufik. And those boys come home, the 6 of them come home, they looked after all our, what's the name, bags, you know, dilly bags and all that. And a lot of them, the blokes had saved up butter and bread and all that and put them in the bags because they thought they were going to bring them home, take them with them. Well, when they emptied, they got them here to Australia, they weren't in a very good state. They had all this old bread and butter and jam.
Yes, we should explain that the unit was split up for the voyage home.
The transport went on one shipping, and we come home on the Orcades on another one. And
you were supposed to come home.
That's right, there. We went back to Batavia, that's right. And on the ship, and then we came ashore off Batavia. We did get a pay before we were there, and I lost all my pay there. There was that was another good cause. The first thing they got when they got their pay was to have a game of two-up. And Rex Bear and the Middle East always used to sort of throw 3 heads. Never ever threw any more. So I knew this because there was a lot of men that didn't know us, you know. And so we started this two-up school, and so Rex's turn came as a flip. And I said, so I backed the heads for three, so then I switched the tails. The Dirty Devils threw 10 heads. I finished up with no money.
And then, as well as losing money, you lost your liberty because you confronted the Japanese. So you were captured in Java, transported effectively for slave railway.
That's right.
Taken by the Japanese to Thailand initially,
yeah,
and then to the first camp, Konyu,
yeah,
on the line, as you call it.
On the line, yeah, on the line. And we were there for quite a while. And from there we went, which was our main camp, was Hintock, where there was two camps on the river, Upper Hintock and Lower Hintock.
Can you describe for us, therefore, the work you had to do? How many hours a day? What sort of labour it was?
Well, the hours started around about 7 o'clock in the morning. You had your breakfast, whatever it may be, a bit cold. It might have been black tea, but it was pappy rice. That was it. And then you were marched out to the lines, and it was mostly cutting works, cutting through the hills, blasting and cutting. And then after that, we'd all that was done, the laying of lines and all that sort of thing. It was all manual labour type of thing. The building of bridges and what have you as you were going through. And it was, as I say, it was just complete major labour work, you know. They used to have the rice bags, which you'd have to carry from the blasting, all the metal and that, you'd have to cart it aside. And all the bulk work of the bridges, that was all done by these, what's named, hooks. It was not nails or that sort of thing, dog-end hooks. The worst part, if you had no shoes or anything like that, was walking over all the shale, the broken rocks and all that sort of thing. And your time of work, it all depended. I mean, the Japs played it pretty cunning. They try to get the blokes to say you had to put down 80 or 100 or 200 centimetres a day. If you did, they'd give you a packet of kitchen eju beans, which were little brown peas sort of thing, very nice, or they'd give you two or three cigarettes. And unfortunately, this didn't work to the benefit of the other blokes who weren't as fit, because they still had to do that same amount of drilling to get that amount of centimetres, whereas the others could go home. As soon as they got it, they could go home. And this was one way of them getting you to work your guts out, and it also didn't help, but it didn't help the other blokes who weren't as fit. We had one Sunday off, but mostly it was work every day of the week, and at least 12 to 14, even up to 16 and 18 hours a day.
That went on for months.
Oh, that went on for months, yeah. What was it? Nearly 2 years. Yeah, that was continued all the time.
Did you contract any diseases, Keith?
I had bacterial dysentery. When I come home, they diagnosed that I had amoebic dysentery. I lost the use of my legs at one part of the game. I couldn't work. That was a sort of thing that I had to use a stick to walk with. This was sort of after the line when we got down to Tarzo. Malaria, I had, that was one of the worst cases I had. After being up to the hill with Red Sheedy, we come home. His little fire he built didn't keep the mosquitoes off, because after that I got a real dose of malaria, and my temperature had gone up to 107.4, and Colonel Dunlop and Major Collette, I remember, because this Major Wood, they had built a shower set up with a spring up in the hill, all bamboo pipelines all the way through, and I was on the stage where I was really out of it, and they said, all I could remember them saying was, we were just sitting under the shower, and this is what they did all night. In the morning, my temperature dropped down to about 98, 99, and I was quite okay. So if it had to have, if we had to have that built, and the Japanese hadn't given permission for that to be built, I wouldn't be here now.
And you were also subjected to beatings, to abuse?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got quite a few, especially that one in the middle of the road after lighting the fire. And Bill the Bastard used to give me quite a beating. That's because the little number 47, we called him, helped me because I was getting beaten because I was always last in the line, so, out on the work.
What was this about lighting a fire? You weren't supposed to?
No, not in the camp, no. This was at the camp where was Ralph Glasson, Laurie McInerney, and, he run a tyre place here. But we were talking, we said, what can we do to make this rice taste better? And we sort of come up with the idea we might be able to toast it.
Right.
And I said, well, if you toast it, you've got to have a blinking fire. And I said, you have to light a fire, you've got to have a stove in which... Well, I said, what say we find some old tin and some rocks and whatever, you know? So we scouted around the camp. We found a lump of tin. We found rocks. Got the bit of wood and all the rest of it. And so we went ahead. And I got nominated as cook. So I lit the fire, and Cliff Allchurch, he was a gentleman, Cliff, and he wasn't very well. So anyway, I did the cooking of them. We made four duvers each. We called them duvers. Mm-hmm. And so when we cooked, I cooked theirs, and then I cooked mine and went in. We were eating. We almost finished, and Cliff said, what are you eating? And we told him. And he said to me, well, you wouldn't mind cooking some for me, would you, Chook? I said, oh, no, all right, Cliff, because I knew he wasn't well. So I went out and lit the fire up again and cooking them away, and with almost finished, and a rock that's about 9 inches in diameter missed my nose by a cigarette paper and went flat plumb in the middle of his duvers.
Yes, yeah.
Scattered them everywhere.
Yeah.
And so I went and saw Cliff. I said, well, if you want your duvers, you better go and sweep them up, because they're all scattered. There's nips just landed a rock right in the middle of them. So anyway, that was that. So anyway, we were in there talking about it. And next thing, we got orders to come to assemble. Well, what the hell's going on? So when we get out there, we assemble there. And there's an officer and a sergeant, and Tim Godley, our doctor, and... Tim said, well, fellas, he said, I've got to tell you, he said, the Japanese officer wants to know, the man who lit the fire, would he please step forward? And yours truly thought, no way am I stepping forward. So after a while, about 4 to 5 minutes passed, and then they had a bit of a conference, and the next thing, Tim said, well, the Japanese officers advised me, if the man that lit the fire doesn't step forward within a minute, they'll start shooting the first man from the rank all the way through until he does, or he'll be shot too. So I had no alternative, yeah. So I stepped forward. That's when I was led to the middle of the road.
Yeah.
And I'm sure his name was Captain Black. He had to belt me one side, and the nip had to belt me from the other side.
So they made an Australian officer beat you?
Yeah, to hit me across the face. And he only gave me a sort of tap, you know.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, look, close your fist and whack me good one. I said, if I go down, you'll be quite happy. Because the more he was, the harder the other bloke was hitting you. And they hit you with that part of
the heel of the hand.
Heel of the hand, yeah. On the point of the jaw there.
Yeah.
And so then... The officer left the sergeant there. We were just standing there, and he had his rifle up at me. I thought, well, God, this is it. And so for some reason, I was forced to look, which I had no intention of doing, and look him in the eye. We looked there for about, it seemed hours, but we looked, and he just put his rifle down and walked off.
You survived.
I survived.
Yeah. It's a remarkable story of survival.
I do like duvers.
Remarkable story of survival, with disease, amoebic dysentery, the beatings, the relentless labour for all that time. When it was over, when the railway was over, what happened to you next?
Well, we were up on the 7 Pagoda Pass, and, not a great deal happened. We just learnt that it had come to our notice now, and and the Nips didn't do anything. They didn't, you know, we were just there, and then we would load them back onto a train. But the strange part, when we went up to that, how things take, you remember things, when we were taken up there and we were unloaded off the train, you had to go down into a valley. You winded your way all the way down, and you had these oil flares, and we're going down there. I was about 11 years of our age, and I went to the only theatre, a film called The Flame, and that was an exact replica of what took place. Now, this is something transpired then, was then transpired to that scene up there on the Pagoda Pass. It was exactly the same thing, walking down this ravine sort of thing with these flares.
Deja vu experience.
Yeah, it was amazing. And how the hell I remembered it, I don't know.
What were the first signs that the war was over? What indicated to you?
Well,
that peace had arrived, 1945.
Well, there was a certain amount of cheering, I suppose, but when we were up in the park,
yes.
But the first thing we knew was these there were twin-engine planes, Australian planes. Oh, what was the name of them? But they threw over our camp. We thought we were going to be bombed.
Right.
But they weren't. They were Australians. I think it was to give us the idea that everything was, you know, it was over.
And how did the Japanese change in terms of attitude?
Well, they weren't yelling at us anymore or anything like that. You know, I think they seemed to be as dumbfounded as what we were. Really, I think you see, because they'd had orders, we were all to be shot.
Yes.
And the day before that was to happen, the orders just come through that they changed their mind, and we weren't shot. But that was the strict instructions, we were all to be shot.
What, therefore, was the first indication not only of the Japanese defeat, but of the Allies' success? You would have met some Allied officers. You would have been told that you were no longer prisoners. How did you get the information?
Oh, hell. I don't know how we got it. We were in the camp, and suddenly we're told it's all over.
Yeah.
You know, that was it. But you've got to remember, we're all in a jungle state of mind. Our mind wasn't tuned to take in to the whole concept of the thing and what it was. I mean, at first you couldn't even get any excitement.
Yeah.
You just couldn't believe it, you know, sort of thing. And it took a little while for the whole thing to. When we were going out to work, and when we were trying to come back, which we come back to Singapore eventually. I mean, it was then the reality of the whole thing hit you. But I can't talk for others because I don't know why it was with me. I do not know, because I came back to Australia, and they flew us home, and I got off that plane at Parafield, and I thought I'd only been away a weekend. I don't ask me why, I don't know. And then we met all our friends, my girlfriend, they were all at Wayville, and I was in La La Land. I mean, and then she thought I'd had my throat cut because they'd given us a sweat towel,
yes,
in Singapore, and I'd done around my neck. You know, so, but I mean, it was so very hard to comprehend the situation. I mean, it was happening, but you could see it happening, but you couldn't, you know, comprehend the whole thing.
You're a philosophical man. I understand you've taken the view that, in a way, it was a good thing to be a prisoner of war, better than going to fight in New Guinea, which is what the other boys from the 2nd, 3rd did.
Well, I mean, let's face it, it was a very, very hard lesson, let's face it, but it taught you a lot about human nature, the bravery and the self-sacrifice men will make under certain circumstances, and it also showed you the other side as well. I mean, we all talk about the brave soldiers and all the rest, but don't forget there's another side too. There's a certain element which is not a very pleasant one, I must admit, But that's something that you don't really talk about. But that's what you learn. You learn there's so much to human nature and human beings, and there's also very many different types. And you learn, and if you don't learn by it, well, then you... And when all said and done, how could I complain when so many died on that line and I was allowed to live? So what have I got to complain about? It was hard. But, I mean, but by the same token, you didn't think after a while. After you've been on that line working all that time, you were just like a zombie. You went in, you come home, you went out, you come home, and you just went backwards and forwards. I mean... We used to talk about apple pie. You could even smell Mum's apple pie and all the rest at one time, but that all disappeared, you know. And so therefore, you didn't even... The funny part was I never ever thought I'd die.
Yeah.
I never even entered my head, you know. So, but everybody has an individual way of experiencing and what they felt and how they experienced.
Perhaps the most rewarding experience, though, was the fact that this lovely young lady, Hazel, whom we'd met before the war, she'd waited for you all this time.
Yeah. Some people make some stupid mistakes in their life. But, yeah, that was an amazing... And yet, I never ever doubted for some reason. I don't know. Look, I can't explain it. I have no idea. But I just went and read it. I've been away for a weekend. I don't think they can believe it either. You know, but the worst part about it was all those blokes that come on the plane, two of us weren't allowed to go home. We had to go to hospital. We had helminthiasis, hookworm.
Hookworm?
Yeah. How the hell they found out, I don't know. But I didn't think they did a medical before we left. So we had to go to Door Park, So they all went off home and we went to hospital.
And you got over that?
Oh, yeah. That was all right. But your memory is not as good as it should be.
But Hazel Rosser waited for you. You got married.
Yeah. 1946. Yeah, yes. Yeah, 15th of March, 1946. Yeah, 16th of March, 1946.
Now, I've seen a photograph of the wedding party, and there are a couple of significant people in that. There's Mr. Tilly, for a start.
Stan Wake.
And Stan Wake.
Stanley Wake, yeah. Yeah, he was a boy and a half, too. Nancy was his sister.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stan had been a POW as well.
Oh, yes, of course. He was from New South Wales, naturally. But I got in contact. He was in our camp, but he used to do a certain amount of physiotherapy work on broken head ulcers and what have you and all that sort of thing. And he taught me a little bit about it. And when I come home, I had no mates at all. I mean, virtually, it was only Eddie. I only thought of Eddie, and he was a groomsman.
Yes.
So I wrote to Dan Wake, and he came from Sydney to be the best man, But he's years older than I, Dan was.
So Eddie Tilly, the former Sturt footballer with whom he'd been out that night down the bay, down to Glenelg, he was the groomsman. And Stan Wake, brother of Nancy Wake, the resistance leader, was your best man.
Yeah, quite a mixture.
And some tremendous stories to tell.
Yeah. I don't know what happened to Stan eventually. He went back to New South Wales. I never heard from Stan again.
So you went back to civilian life, and you had a number of jobs. You kept your old job, I believe.
I went back to the LA Co-op and then had a bit of a falling out with the boss there. I went into menswear. I started off with the groceries, then I started went into menswear, and they brought this bloke. No, I'm not mentioning names because somebody might.
Yeah.
But anyway, Stewie, that was our boss. They used to like the grog. They used to be, he was in the RSL where they were drinking beer. And by this time, I'd learned the price and what have you, and the buying and what have you. And then once again, this bloke was about 10, 15 years older than I. And I was still silly as POW anyway. Still hadn't recovered. Anyway, I finished up one day. He was going into Stewie's office and he was learning all the bits. So I went and saw Skid Ray, our boss. I said, I've had this. and I want to get another job. And I went and told Ellie, he was up in the cash box upstairs, and I told Ellie, he said, wait a minute. She got on the phone, said, I'll ring my brother, he's down at John Martin. So she rang her brother, he's in charge of menswear down there. So I said to Mr. Ray, I said, well, look, I want to, I'm getting ahead of myself. And so Ellie rang and she come back downstairs. She said, look, she said, go down and see him. She said, he can fit you in straight away down there. Because she told me about history and all this, you see. And so I went and saw Mr. Ray. I said, do I have to wait the fortnight? He said, no, Keith, you take the chance. He said, I can't interfere because he's the boss, you know. And so I left. So I went down to him. In the meantime, I put in, what the hell, my brother-in-law made me do it. I had no idea I was ever going to be a clerk. So he said, put in to go into the Commonwealth Government. It's the best job in the world. So I did this. I was only there at the John Martin's about a fortnight, and I got a call from the Commonwealth Government to go to Veterans Affairs. So I had to say to this bloke, do you mind if I go straight away? So I said, no, under the circumstances. So I left there, and that's where I finished my... And that was my time at the Veterans Affairs, and the most wonderful time of my life. It was like going home from home.
Yes, you were naturally attuned to it. You were very successful there, I understand. And you had a particular talent in working in Veterans Affairs because you could sniff out people who were trying it on.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had all their files. I mean, you know. Oh, no, it was a lot of things you could do. And I mean, I suppose this is the way I look at it, but I think they all thought I was still silly because I could say anything and do anything and nobody took any notice of me, you know. And I used to say things to Doc, and he was a terrific bloke, Doc Morris, and some things I said to him, you know, where they'd interfere with blokes' pensions and all that, especially anxiety cases and all that. And I said, you're only creating more trouble by... Because they hadn't been to a doctor or hadn't seen a psychiatrist and that. Oh, they said, well, he's finished, but he was. But they were happy. They had a little bit of pension that was giving them a bit of what's that. But as soon as they found that they had to struggle to, once again, and they lost that little bit of money, once again, back out to hospital, they were, you know. And they were genuine blokes. I mean, we used to have one bloke come in the county. He was an alcoholic. Oh, God, he was a funny bloke. And swear, you know. So I thought, how the hell am I going to get rid of him? The funny part was, he was a good soldier and used to be sympathised, you know, this is the way he finished up. But he came in there one day, he's going crook, and I'm looking at him, I said, I'm looking at you, he's William, looking at him. I said, I don't think I'm going to see you much longer. He said, William, I said, I think you'll be dead. I think the worms will be going to feed you very, very soon. Well, did he give me... And he stole... And I never saw him from that day. I don't know where he went to. I'm trying to think of his name. I can know him quite well.
In your own mind, Keith, in those years, did you have a lingering hate of the Japanese who treated you so badly?
Oh, I did, when I first come home.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, not only the way they treated me, but the whole concept of the whole situation. And as I've said before, I had no reaction to my POW life until after my son was born. And that's where I got hit with the whole thing like a bolt of lightning. And I was a nutcase for about 5 or 6 years, complete nutcase. And it was very, very hard on the family. But it was only because of Dr. Binns, and he didn't realise that all the notes, I was handling all the OPC notes, clinical notes, medical notes, the door parked there and everywhere. And I come across my own clinical notes from him. And this, yeah, I think he must have been a nutcase too, because he said, this is a very good type of man.
Yes.
I said, I don't know where he got that from. But anyway, and it made me stop and think. I said, well, if he can think that, why? And then I started to think, well, when all said and done, who am I hurting? I'm not hurting them at all. The only one I'm affecting is my family and myself. So that's when I started to change my life, and it started to, and what with Dr. And he taught me psychotherapy, He didn't want me to have insulin or any of those sort of things, but he said I was a good case for psychotherapy, where they taught you that when any of these things from your life, POW, that started to upset you and send you over the hill, that you were switched your mind straight away onto something pleasant, didn't matter what it was, but something altogether. And it took me about 8 months, and I do that now automatically, without even thinking. If something comes, look, I'm going to be unhappy, or there's something, I automatically, it just switches onto something else straight away. And it was only through Dr. Bids and all that made, I changed my mind, life.
Then many years later, long retired and into your 90s, you were selected for a contingent of ex-prisoners of war, taken on a goodwill mission to Japan. What was that experience like?
Oh, I still can't believe it. It was amazing. The kid from down under going to Japan. That's the last thing in the world I ever thought of doing. But that was an amazing trip. And as I say, with Jack Thomas, I mean, what better mate could you have gone to go away with in any case? And I took my son-in-law, and it made me popular.
What were your impressions of the Japanese people on this goodwill visit then?
I must admit, they were a different generation. I mean, the Japanese told their nation very little of what had transpired. And they had very little interest in us. They were only interested in their own life. I mean, we were more interested in those. We did visit a family that Jack had, was in the camp where he worked in the mines. We met that family there. They were beautiful people. They really were. The girls that we had on our trip, the one that led the tour, a 50-year-old woman, she was a terrific person. And our sister, the nurse, she was and then all the other tour guides that we had, they were no different to us. Exactly, they dressed like Western, they thought like Western people, and they were very interested. And when we had our big conference there, I had about four or five girls, young girls, lining, and they were very interested. They then wanted to know what it was all about, They wanted to know the history of it, because at the convention it all come up because we had to give our stories.
Yes.
But I didn't. I changed because he had his story made. He had to give his talk, and he was pacing his talk on mine, and I switched mine at the last moment. And I told them all, if they don't get their heads together, the countries of the world, the Western world, the Japanese world, and all of them, if they don't start to think and get rid of the ICs, I said the world's not going to be worthwhile living in.
Right.
I said that's the thing you've got to do now.
ISIS terrorism.
Yeah. I said, because they're going to rule the world.
A great privilege to talk to you today. I need to explain one thing for anyone who listens to this interview. You may have heard a clock ticking in the background and striking occasionally. We haven't turned the clock off, and Keith is going to tell you why.
Well, then when that clock stops, I stop. So I keep it going. While that's ticking, I'm ticking. And I've got to see my heart specialist tomorrow to make sure my pacemaker's still ticking too.